Welcome to the last week of this course. So you know, last week we discussed everything regarding the matter. So, you know, a little bit about dark energy, a little bit about dark matter, a little bit about why we think there might be a hot Big Bang. And so one of the indications is, for example, this Big Bang nucleosynthesis and stuff like that. So this week will be more theoretical. So we'll do less estimates and less real data calculations. So I'll try to basically today talk a little bit more about the CMB power spectrum, and then starting tomorrow, I'll tell you how we'll be building towards the fact why inflation is actually good for fluctuations. It provides the right initial data for our eventual observation of this power spectrum. So today, just a little bit more about the power spectrum, CMB power spectrum. And so basically there are three sources. You can very approximately divide the sources for the CMB power spectrum. And so one of them is the primordial fluctuations. And this is precisely what comes nicely from the inflation theory. And so we will discuss that. So this is actually, sort of it starts as quantum, and then it becomes classical and whatever. So it provides like initial conditions for your plasma oscillations in some sense. Then you have the plasma oscillations. We talked about them a little bit. So whenever you have plasma, you have pressure, but you have also attractive forces, and so that's why the plasma starts oscillating. And of course, these oscillations are eventually reflected in your CMB. And finally, lots of dirty physics, secondary anisotropies. So whereas the first two, you can known as primary anisotropies. Everything what is not primary, everything what happened after the CMB was released is called secondary anisotropies. So after CMB was released, and so there's quite a few effects which can actually happen, after these photons roam free. And so one of the effects is, for example, as you form the first stars, the first stars, of course, start shining. And so then you have lots of plasma around. And so this plasma is heated by this shining from the stars. Okay, and so as it gets heated, actually it gets ionized. So you have typically hydrogen or whatever, and so then if you bombard it with photons, high energetic photons from stars, you ionize it again, and so then you have basically like the original plasma, but now of course it's less dense or whatever. But you start producing again new CMB if you want due to the stars. Another thing is that, you can send a photon, let's say, to a gravitational well. And so as the photon is going down the well, it's gaining energy. Okay, so it's blue shifted. However, it may happen that this well actually disperses in time. And so the gravitational potential does not exist anymore. So instead of climbing up the well again, which would, of course, redshift the photon, and so the photon would end up exactly as it started. So now, because the well dispersed, actually it was just blue shifted at the beginning, and then it's blue shifted forever because there is no climbing up again. Or you can do the same thing, but now with gravitational potential like that, and then it's the other way around. And so that's another source of anisotropies. And then you have also, various scatterings and stuff like that, Doppler shift. So lots of dirty physics actually can happen and the secondary phase with this CMB. So let me just mention some of them. So it's this, it could be integrated or not integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. Which is related to this gravitational redshift and stuff like that. You can also have, I don't know if you have been to this opening of our Center for Universe. So Sunayev was there. So Sunayev-Zeldovich effect. And that's basically related to the distortion of CMB by, you know, inverse Compton scattering. But you can also have a Doppler shift. So lots of things can happen to CMB after it is released, and they of course modify the CMB spectrum. And so they are all, you know, the secondary anisotropies. And you will discuss all these things in the explorations in cosmology course. So I will not really discuss them here, but it's really quite dirty physics. Okay, so questions for these things? Okay, so now let me repeat how we discussed the CMB spectrum last time. So if you discuss the observed temperature, yes?
Between the non-integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect and how we observe the primordial fluctuations and plasma oscillations, is there a difference in that?
Is there a difference? Yes, so if you have non-integrated one, yeah, it basically reflects...
Does it reflect a different one, or...?
So if you put non-integrated, so it's the like a primordial Sachs-Wolfe effect, so it happens during... The CMB was released during the gravitational potentials. That's in the original plasma, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So integrated is perhaps more interesting because it's like later, and yeah.
Yeah, but the non-integrated effect is like what we call the seed for large structure, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Other questions? Okay. So we observe the temperature, which depends on the direction in the sky, and so this thing has fluctuations. And so we parameterize these fluctuations as delta t. We subtract the average temperature, T0. And if you want, the average temperature is just an average over all these things over the sky. So it's just 1 over 4 pi and integrate over the angle on the sky and t of n. So n is, of course, the direction which you are observing this thing. And we know that this T0 is approximately 2.7 Kelvin or something like that. And then you have these teeny tiny fluctuations, which are of the order of 10 to minus 5. Okay. So now we expand them, expand this delta T in spherical harmonics. I'm just repeating what we have done last week, spherical harmonics. Because you are on the sphere, so that's a natural thing to do. And so then you write delta t as sum over L and then sum over m and ALM, which are the coefficients of expansion, ALM, and then YLM are our basis spherical harmonics. Okay, so we observe that, or we expand that, and of course, you know, the observation gives you what these ALM coefficients are. And then you define the power spectrum, which is the observed one. So observed power spectrum. It's basically the length of this vector ALM for a fixed. So if you fix L, then this is a vector in 2L plus 1 dimensional space. And if you take its magnitude, then this is rotational invariant, and it's a good quantity to measure. So this is CL observed. This is precisely that. So 2L plus 1, and then sum over M from minus L to L and ALM square. Okay, so this is the observed power spectrum, and this is what gives you this nice picture. What we observe today. Okay, so this is just a repetition. Of course, what you would like now to do is that you would like to theoretically predict what the CL has to be, and then compare this observation. So now you have to build a theory, you know, build on inflation or something like that. So physical theory, which gives you that this is what is seen. However, you are in much, much tougher situation here, because typically you can repeat the experiments, right? So you build a theory, you build quantum field theory or quantum electrodynamics, and then you study the scattering of something, and so then you make a theoretical prediction, and then you make lots of experiments, repeating the same experiment and again, and then you compare, is the theory actually giving you the right prediction? Here, you have to make the theory, but then you have to compare with only one observation. You have only one universe, which we see, so the universe happens only once, and you have to compare that theory with that observation. So you have to do statistics on one ensemble, on one experiment. Okay, so that's of course problematic. I'll give you the key ingredients. And if you don't believe anything of that, that's fine. So we want to theoretically predict this CL. And so in order to predict that, you'll do these statistics on one ensemble. So first of all, we consider an ensemble of possible universes. And then, you know, all of this. So if you are doing statistics, you consider an ensemble, a huge ensemble of things, and then you randomly open the box and you see what the properties of that one particular example are. So okay, so we have this ensemble of all possible universes, and then we measure randomly chosen. So now what we measure here is this set of ALMs. So for each L and M, I measure some quantity here. So these are our variables which we measure. So we measure A1, 1, A1, 2, and whatever. Okay, 2, 1. So we measure randomly chosen ALM, and then of course, in order this to make sense, you have to say what is the probability that we will measure precisely this chosen ALM, so this concrete ALM. So with probability distribution, and that, so this is my probability that I measure this set of ALMs. So probability distribution.
When you say we measure randomly chosen, it's basically we measure the one we live in.
So of course we measure one, right? So this is, we are building theory for this, right? So at this point we consider all possible universes with all possible, you know, physics and all possible ALMs, and then we randomly open one universe, and one universe happens. But we have to then say, you know, so this you know gives you some fixed ALMs, but then you have to say, you know, your theory has to say what is the probability that this ALM actually will happen.
And maybe it's a pedantic question that we measure ELM or just the sum, because you say we measure all of them.
Well, you could measure ALM, but that's not rotationally invariant. So if you rotated your sky, that wouldn't really give you. So that's why this is a better quantity to consider. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So now, of course, this probability distribution allows you to calculate some interesting quantities, for example, the correlation functions. So this thing will be a two-point correlation function. It has two ALMs in it, so it's a two-point correlation function. But in general, you can consider, you know, any endpoint correlation functions. Okay, so then once we have this probability, so this is given by our theory. So for example, you know, if you consider inflation to be right, so then you will get some, you know, all these effects here. Then you will get some probability distribution. And then can calculate correlation functions with respect to this, you know, probability distribution. And so what I mean by that, so of course our variable side is ALM, and then you put AL prime and prime, and you know AL star M, AL A star LM, and stuff like that. And this is simply given by the integral with respect to this probability distribution. So you, it's an integral over a product of all DALMs, DALM. Well, that's just the. And then the measure is given by, you still have to provide this probability. So this is my measure for the integral. And then I insert whatever I want to calculate here. So then ALM, AL prime, M prime, and whatever you want to insert here. So here, stands here. And this is your measure. OK, so that's form a definition of what you mean by this correlation function here. So now what you would like to do is really to build a theory for what this P has to be and compare this observation. Okay. So now what is observed and what is definitely confirmed, that this probability distribution is rotationally invariant. Okay. So now P is rotational invariant. That's something, you know, that has been checked. So this is fine. It's rotational invariant. But also, you may make an assumption. It's just the simplest possible assumption that actually P is Gaussian. And so that's an assumption. P is Gaussian. And that's, of course, still a question. But you know, it seems that so far all the observations are consistent with the fact that actually it is Gaussian. So what I mean by that is that by definition, here is that all the correlation functions are simply given in terms of the two-point correlation functions. Okay, so that what I mean by this, by definition, is that all endpoint correlation functions given in terms of terms of two-point correlation function. And so to calculate them, I simply use the Wick theorem as you know it. So Y Wick theorem. So this is my definition of Gaussian, which makes sense. So you can check that if you have an exponential Gaussian thing, then this is true. Wick theorem is true. So now I'll just be using this as a definition. So of course, what it means is that if you have odd number of these, then it is equal to zero. If you have an even number, so for example, A1, A2, A3, A4, it's just through the Wick contractions. So I first contract this thing and then that thing, so that's one term. But then I also have to consider A1 and A3, and then A1 and A4. Okay, so you will have terms like A1, A2, A3, A4, and then plus A1, A3, A2, A4, and then plus A1, A4, A2, A3. Okay, so this is what I mean, that the distribution is Gaussian. And as I said, you can check whether actually the observation is consistent with this or not. So far, it seems that, yeah, it's the simplest possible assumption, and it seems to work. So now, of course, that doesn't prevent theoreticians to ask, what would happen if it's not Gaussian? And so people calculate what this power spectrum would look like if it were not Gaussian. Also, they calculate these non-Gaussianities. So let's say three-point correlation function. What is the theoretical prediction from a given theory for a three-point correlation function? Is it really zero, or is it something else? Okay, so now, of course, we are talking about the field of cosmology. So it's pretty embarrassing that the first person who actually calculated these three-point correlation functions and these non-Gaussianities was not a cosmologist, but was actually high-energy physicist, famous Juan Maldacena. Okay, so if you are interested, read Maldacena's paper. So Maldacena and it's Astro. It's his only Astro paper, I think. It's 2002-106-03, which is non-Gaussianities. It's actually not so trivial to calculate these three-point correlation functions or whatever, because you have to gauge fix. So you know that if you consider the gravitational field, you have only 2 degrees of freedom, but you describe it in terms of metric, which has apparently 10 degrees of freedom and whatever. So actually the biggest thing is how to properly gauge fix and how to identify what the 2 degrees of freedom are in the theory. And so, as I said, embarrassing for cosmologists, it was calculated by somebody else. And I don't know if you still reproduce that, but if you look several years back, basically the explorations in cosmology course was devoted to this paper. And so the paper was discussed in 10 lectures or something like that. Although it's not very long paper, it's there's lots of things going on. So anyway, you can just scan it through. All right. So non-Gaussianity is still possible, but haven't been observed. Okay. So now we want to use this rotational invariance and this Gaussianity to actually. So all we care about is just a two-point correlation function. So if we know two-point function, then we can reconstruct all of these. So how to constrain this two-point function? So first of all, we know that if you just consider this thing here, now if you look, our definition of delta t is just sum of ALMs and YLM. So now if I take average value, what do I get? Zero. Okay, so this must be equal to zero. because there's only one ALM, and I consider this Gaussian thing. So now, if you want two-point correlation function for the temperature, so now I look at the temperature at the direction n and the temperature at the direction n prime. And so if this is rotationally invariant, then of course this must only depend on the scalar product of n and n prime. So it must only depend on the angle between the two directions. So this must be some function of n and then n prime. So it's the function of the angle. Okay. And so now, because this depends only on this angle, you can make an expansion of this function in new bases, which depends only on angles, and that's the Legendre polynomials. Okay, so the Legendre polynomials is the right basis to expand here. So here I'm just motivating what this two-point function could be, but I could just write it down. Anyway, 2L plus 1 over 4 pi, some stupid prefactor, and then the coefficients of expansion I will call CL, and then this is my basis, PL and prime. So this is the basis I'm expanding in, and these are now my coefficients of expansion. Okay, so now you use the fact, and that's where this stupid prefactor comes from, is that this thing can be related to some sum over the spherical harmonics. Okay, so the Legendre polynomials are just sum over two spherical harmonics. So this thing can be written as 4 pi over 2L plus 1, and then sum over m, ylm of n, and y star lm of n prime. Okay, so this is just mass. So this is certainly true. Okay, so far so good. So now what you have to do is that you have to plug in for what delta t of n is through this definition of delta t. Okay, so I'll have sum over L and sum over m of ALM, YLM, and then for the other one as well. So now you see that on the left-hand side you have two y's, on the right-hand side you have two y's as well. And then you compare whatever you see in front of these y's. And so once you compare that, I'm getting an average of two a's on the left-hand side and then cl on the right-hand side and some numbers, whatever. So actually from here, you conclude that this two-point correlation function is precisely given by this cl as I define it here, a l prime m prime star is equal to delta L prime, delta M prime, and then CL. Okay, so this rotational invariance basically guarantees that the two-point correlation function is given by these coefficients of expansion in this rotational invariant Legendre polynomial expansion. Okay, I could have defined it from the very beginning. I would say, yeah, the correlation function of two a's is just CL. Yeah, and then I could use the Gaussianity to calculate any other. But I think, you know, this argument, you know, what the CL is, so CL is really the coefficient of expansion in terms of these angles of your temperatures. So that gives the physical meaning of this CL. Okay, so now of course this CL need not be that CL here. So this is something which we observe, right? And this is something which we theoretically predict. Okay, so for this we have theory. So this is a theoretical CL. Okay, and so now we would like to compare the two, and it better be that if I take an average value of whatever is predicted here, of the observation, and then the two actually match. Okay, no questions so far? Okay, it's all dark magic. Ah, I haven't used the blackboard, okay. So now we want to relate this theoretically predicted CL and this observation CL observed. And so in average, they better agree. So first, the average. Okay, so if you do the average of CL observed, okay, so what it is? So it's average of 1 over 2L plus 1, and then sum over M, and then ALM square, which is ALM star and ALM. Okay, so that's, I'm just plugging the CL observed there, and this is what it is. So now if you have average of sum, of course it's an average of each and every term, the sum of averages. So this is 1 over 2L plus 1, sum over M, and then ALM star ALM. So now I relate this guy to my theoretical CL. And so this is just delta LL, delta MM, which doesn't do really anything, right? So delta MM is 1, delta LL is 1. And then CL. So I'm summing over M of CLs, and I have 2L plus 1 of those. So this is just CL. Okay, so indeed, this observational thing is related to my theoretical thing, is that if I make an average of one, I get the other. So that's fine. So this is what we better have. So now, the second thing is that, well, average is nice, but what are the fluctuations around the average? Right, and this is precisely what we call the cosmic variance thing, and this is the origin of these error bars in your CL graph. Okay, so the second thing which is interesting to calculate is this cosmic variance. So now I'm explaining what this really is. There's nothing mysterious about it, and it's just, you know, the fluctuations around this average value. So you define it as you would, so CL minus CL observed divided by CL square, the whole thing square, and then you average over that. Okay, so now you will take square root of eventually of this thing, but it doesn't matter. So I'm just calculating, you know, what is the variations of this as you would do always. Okay, so now what is this thing here? Okay, so if I divide by CL, I have 1 minus CL observed over CL, the whole thing square. So 1 is 1. And then you have minus 2 times CL observed over CL. And then you have plus CL observed over CL square. I'm just expanding what that means. So now average of 1 is 1. So that's simple. So now CL in these calculations is just a number. It's whatever we theoretically predicted. So I average only over CL observed, right? So I only average these guys. So then you are doing an average over CL observed. But we already calculated that. So the average of CL observed is CL. So then the second term actually gives you CL over CL minus 2. So it's minus 2. And then the last term is plus, I'm taking this CL square out, it's just a number, and then CL observed square, and then average over that. Okay, so now we have 1 minus 2 is minus 1, and then plus 1 over CL square. So now I have to plug for CL observed these things here. Okay, so I'll have sum over m, and then I will have sum over m prime, because I will have CL, well, I have sum over m and sum over m prime, and I will have 1 over 2L plus 1 square. Okay, so 1 over CL square, 2L plus 1 square times. And then you have, so times sum m and m prime, and then you want to average over the things, so it's ALM, ALM, ALM star. So that's one CL, and then the other CL is this m prime, so ALM, ALM star. Okay, so we have to calculate this four-point correlation function, but we assume Gaussianity. And because we assume Gaussianity, we can use this expansion here, so we'll have three terms here, which are products of two-point functions. Okay, so this thing here will be okay, ALM, A star LM, and then A LM prime, A star LM prime. That's one term. And then we have two more terms. So plus ALM, ALM star. ALM, ALM prime, and then ALM star, ALM prime star. That's the second term. And then finally, we have this one is that one. So plus ALM, ALM prime star, and then ALM star, ALM prime. Okay, so these are the three terms which we have using the big theorem. So now this is quite simple. So this one is precisely our definition of what we mean by CL. So this is delta M, M, delta LL, CL. And then you have delta LL, delta M prime, M prime, and another CL. So that's, for example, the first term. So now if you look at these things, so we have sums over M and M prime. So this delta L, L doesn't really do anything, it's always one. So we can drop these delta L, L's everywhere. So we will not consider those, it's always one. Then what you will always have also is CL square. There's nothing else you could have, right? So you will have CL square. And then this thing here is just one, and this thing here is just one. And then you have sum over m and m prime. So that actually gives you 2L plus 1 square terms. Okay. So the first thing, the first sum over the first term, actually gives you 2L plus 1 squares, because we have two sums over m and m prime, and then you'll have CL square. And that's what the contribution from the first term. Okay, so now similarly, you can do the second term. So here, let me do this one is simpler, and that one is more complicated. I'll leave that to you. So So this one here is just delta, well, LL we will just not care about. So we have delta M and then M prime coming from here. And then the same thing here, delta M and then M prime. And then CL square. Okay, so delta M M prime twice is just delta M M prime. And so what it means is that now actually this thing chooses that M has to be equal to M prime in the sum. So I have only one sum left, not two. So this actually gives me 2L plus 1 times CL square. Okay. So that's the contribution of the last term. So finally, there is a dirty trick. So this seems like you have two annihilation operators and you are averaging them, so you should get zero. But actually, you are not doing annihilation operators. You are just doing probabilistic things on these expansions in spherical harmonics. And actually, in order your delta t to be real, so you know that delta t here is a real quantity. And that actually tells you that the complex conjugate ALMs are somehow related to ALMs themselves. So the reality of that thing gives you that if you want, ALM star is related to ALM by the following formula, AL minus M. Okay, so that's a magic formula, how you can actually translate, you know, one of the A's to A stars, and similarly here, A star to one of the A's. And so if you do that, it's obvious that you are also getting CL out of this guy and CL out of that guy. And if you, you know, do these minus ones properly, you will again find that there is, so obviously there will be something like delta M and M prime. So you'll again kill one of the sums. So only one sum is left. So this term intuitively has to give you just one sum, which is 2L plus 1, and then CL square. And actually, if you, you know, treat the minus signs correctly, this is precisely what you get. Okay, so we have now these three terms. So let me finish that calculation. So in other words, this cosmic variance is now, so we have minus 1, and then we have 1 over CL square 2L plus 1 square. And then we have this term here, 2L plus 1 square CL square, and then plus 2L plus 1 CL square plus 2L plus 1 CL square. So this is what you get. And if you collect all the terms, of course, CL square cancels this CL square. So in the end, you just get a number. And the number is 2 times 2L plus 1. Okay, so this is how you calculate this cosmic variance. So in other words, people are interested in the square root of this thing. So then you have CL minus CL observed over CL square average and then square root. And this is 2 over 2L plus 1 square root of that. And this is what is called cosmic variance. Okay, and this is precisely, yes?
So this assumption that P is Gaussian also means that if I take this guy and I divide it in a bunch of solid angles, and then I measure the fluctuation of the temperature in that solid angle, this distribution in the sky will also be Gaussian, right?
Is Gaussian.
This assumption implies that.
Yeah.
How do I see that?
How do you see?
So again, the question is, does the assumption that P is Gaussian implies that the distribution of temperature fluctuations as a function of the solid angle is also Gaussian?
Yeah.
And how do I see that?
Well, I think, you know, what people really observe is they look at these, you know, higher order correlation functions and stuff like that, and they basically verify whether the big theorem is true or not.
Thank you.
I don't know how really this is observed. So this is the origin of these things here. And you see that the cosmic variance is only, you know, big enough if L is actually small enough. So if L goes, you know, large, then this thing is, you know, getting much smaller. And so that's why you have these, you know, for small L, you have these large error bars. It's precisely coming from here. Are there any questions to cosmic variance? Yeah.
So this assumption that we're choosing a random set of ALs, how do people justify it? Do they just, like you said, use to say, okay, this is Gaussian and we're not going to think about it? Or do they actually say, oh, there's a multiverse?
It depends on the person, right? So some people say, yeah, every universe actually happens, and so we have all possibilities, and we just, you know, you want to discuss our universe or whatever. Yeah.
What if people don't believe in this?
Well, still, you know, so you, yeah. I told you at the beginning that you shouldn't really, okay. You don't have to believe all this, right? So but yeah, so certainly you want to do, you know, some prediction based on some theory for the CL, but the problem is that, yeah, you have only one measurement. And so there are ways how to do statistics on the hand. This is the way how to do it. I personally don't know much about these statistics, so I don't really know. All right. So we have discussed what the cosmic variance means and how this statistics is done. So now we neglected so far one important property of CMB, and that property is that the CMB, because it's photons, it not only has temperature, but it also has polarization. And the reason for this, why actually the polarization is important here, is that at the surface of the last scattering, so as you remember, we had the plasma and whatever, and the true decoupling of photons actually happened, you know, through this Thomson scattering or whatever. But Thomson scattering produces actually polarized light. So the polarization is actually, you know, non-trivial. So CMB is polarized. And so we want to describe this extra information in CMB. So far we just talked about the temperature. Produced, the polarization is produced by Thomson scattering. Before the photons decoupled from the plasma. And so if you have the polarization, so it's simply a vector EI, you know that the polarization is perpendicular to the momentum of propagation. And you also normalize it. So delta IJ EI EJ is 1. And EI PJ delta IJ is 0 because it's perpendicular. Okay. So now, in the same way as we, you know, when we talked about thermodynamics in expanding universe, we had the distribution function for, you know, how many, telling us how many particles in a given phase space volume. So now we want this for the polarized particles. So given the polarization EI, I can calculate how many particles are there with the given polarization. So number of particles in the given phase space volume is now given by this thing here, and then d3p, d3q, 3q, and then 2 pi cube. So before, we had just f. So now we have some tensor, fij, which is symmetric tensor. And this is my fixed polarization, ei and ej. And so this is the distribution function again. And it's called polarization tensor, I think. So anyway, so fij, as before, is a function of q, p, and t, but it's a symmetric tensor. Telling us about, you know, how many particles I find with the given polarization vector E. Okay, so that's the extra information which is also contained in CMB. So now let us look at how we could observe this extra information. So of course, what you measure, if you measure this polarization tensor, what you measure is that if ij at q on the airs, p is the momentum of the coming in photon. So it's actually related to the n times the energy of the photon, the omega times n, or whatever, with minus sign because it's coming at u, and t is now. So that's what you really measure, this polarization tensor now. Okay. So now how we would like to do the similar thing. So we would like to define the power spectrum, but now for polarization, in some sense. So what you do is that you look at the mask book and find our Google SVT decomposition. So scalar vector tensor decomposition. And the statement is, well, you know that if you have a matrix, you can decompose it into symmetric part, antisymmetric part, and trace, or something like that. So precisely, we will be doing the same thing, but now for tensors. So any symmetric tensor in d dimensions can be decomposed as follows. So you start with a tensor Tij, and you decompose it into scalars, vectors, and tensors in the following way. So this is symmetric, Tij. So it has d times d plus 1 over 2 components, right? So if you have symmetric tensor in d dimensions, there's d times d plus 1 over 2 components. And so then you write it as another tensor with two indices tt. And then a vector, nabla I vj, symmetrized product, so nabla I vj plus nabla j vi, and then a scalar, nabla I nabla j on scalar, and then minus 1/2 gij nabla square on phi, and finally there is one more term, plus 1 over d, Gij and psi. This is bad. Okay. So anyway, so you decompose it into a tensor, a vector, scalar, and another scalar. Okay, so that's why SVT decomposition. So now I forgot one T here. So there's a T standing for V. So T and T looks the same, T. We have two T's. So one of them stands for traceless, and the other one stands for transverse. So what I mean by this HIJTT is that the divergence of this HIJ dt equals to zero. So that means transverse. So that's one t. And the other t is that the trace is actually zero. So gij hij dt equals to zero, so traceless. Okay, so transverse and traceless is these two t's which stand by hij. Okay, so similarly, the vector t, well, the vector cannot be traceless, but it can be transverse. So again, double I on bi t equals to zero, so the vector is transverse. Okay, so now we have, you started with d times d plus 1 over 2 components. So now this thing is symmetric still. So it should have also d times d plus 1 over 2 components. However, you impose d conditions here and another condition here. So these are, you know, so it has d plus 1 less components than this guy. So now this thing here is a vector, should have d components. But you are imposing one condition, so it has d minus 1 components, actually. So now you're missing two components. And the two components are precisely heading in the scalar field phi and in the scalar field psi. So if you do the counting, this is what happens. OK, so this is at least counting-wise, it's fine. So now if you look at specifically what we need to do is that we need to discuss our polarization tensor. And so we know that we have to discuss, you know, what happens on the sky, and the sky is the sphere. So we actually have to apply this SVT decomposition in two dimensions on the sphere. So specifically in two dimensions in d equal to 2. So if you look at your transverse traceless tensor, so then the symmetric tensor has three components. So now the transverse condition implies two conditions. Traceless condition implies one condition. These are actually three conditions you imply. So you have only three components minus three conditions, so you have zero. Okay. So hij dt in this case is equal to zero. And then you have the vector. But again, you have one condition on that vector. So actually, it's only one component hiding in the vector. And so you can write it as a gradient of another scalar. Okay, so basically the statement is that vi of t is a Hodge-Dohl of epsilon ij and then dj of a scalar, which I'll call chi. Okay, so you have the Hodge-Duality through the epsilon symbol, the pseudo-tensor, and of a gradient of a scalar. So now, in other words, in two dimensions, all we have, because this hijtt is zero, and this is just related to a scalar, then we have only three scalars. So only three scalars. So we have the scalar chi, we have the scalar phi, and we have the scalar psi. Right, so that's all what is left in your SVT decomposition if you are in two dimensions. So now if you look at the psi thing, so psi is something like the trace part. It's what stands, you know, in front of gij. So now if you want to look at, you know, you are expanding this fij in terms of gij times psi and whatever. So gij And you eventually, to calculate the number of particles, you want to contract this EI and EJ. So you have GIJ, EI, EJ times psi plus other terms. But of course, of the normalization, EI and EJ is normalized. GIJ is actually 1. So this really what it does is it's just, you know, gives you psi times the volume integral, d3p, d3q over 2 pi. So what it actually gives you is it doesn't tell you anything about the polarization. It tells you about the temperature. It tells you about something which is polarization independent. So this gives you the temperature. So think about it, what I just said. But actually, this doesn't describe the polarization. It's just a trace part, and it's just no, you know, E square is 1, so that's why it doesn't. So these two are actually interesting, and these describe polarization. And of course, it must be so, because you know that there is only 2 polarizations for photons, so actually only two things can, you know, talk about the polarization. Okay, so now I'm running out of time, but what you do is you define, okay, so let us write this tensor decomposition in 2 dimensions. So we have Tij is equal to, now for the vector part, it will just be epsilon I k nabla j nabla k on chi. So that's the vector part. And then you have plus nabla I nabla j minus 1/2 gij nabla square acting on phi. And then you would have the psi part, but the psi part just gives you the temperature, so let's not write it. Okay, so you have these two parts in d equal to 2 dimensions. So now you take this operator, and because it's related to epsilon, so if you think about electromagnetism, so anything, you know, if you have Fij or whatever, Er, well, if the vector potential or Fij, the spatial part of that is the B field, and the zero part is the E field. Okay, so you will call this to be this operator, you will call the E operator, and this with epsilon, you will call the B operator. Okay, so now to get the basis for these polarizations, you just act these operators on your spherical harmonics. And that defines what is called tensorial harmonics. So one of them, y, the electric one, so now it has, the tensorial harmonic has these components I and j. And it has also these L and M, as it had before. And this is given by some stupid prefactor, 2 times L minus 2 factorial over L plus 2 factorial square root of that. So that's a stupid prefactor. But then it's the operator, the electric operator, acting on the spherical harmonic. So it's nabla I, nabla j, minus 1/2 gij, nabla square, and then acting on epsilon lm, and then n. So this is one tensorial harmonic. And the other one will be with the other operator. So then you will have epsilon ij b lm on n. And this is given by the same prefactor, but I have also 1/2 from this thing here. So this is 1/2 epsilon I nabla j plus 1/2 j and I. So I'll have 1/2, then the same prefactor here, and then epsilon I k nabla j nabla k, and then plus the other way around, epsilon j k nabla I nabla k, acting on my spherical harmonic. Okay, so this is the definition of the tensorial harmonics, and if you study, you know, radiation and stuff like that, this is what you will see and what you will use to study properties of radiation. So now, what is beautiful about this decomposition, that various parts are actually orthogonal, right? So otherwise, it wouldn't make sense consider these decompositions, if they were not orthogonal, so you know, all paths are different projections. And so now what you can do is that you expand your polarization vector in terms of these tensorial harmonics. And beautiful thing about them is that they form the complete basis in the space of two tensors, two symmetric two tensors. Okay, so you can decompose your polarization tensor in terms of YE and YB, and also the psi one, which is the temperature. But we already did that, so let me just consider the non-trivial part for the polarization. And so you write, so these form complete bases, and they are orthogonal. So if you do YE and YB and you integrate over them, you get zero and stuff like that. And so can decompose Fij, our polarization tensor, into sum over L and M, and then A L M, and then Y L M E I J, and then plus sum over L and M, A L M, Y B, I J, and L M. Okay, so now this is the complete basis. These are the coefficients of expansion. So just to stress that these A's are with respect to the E polarization, I put an E here. So I'll have A L M E, and that's my coefficients of expansion in terms of this guy. And then this one is the B ALMs. Okay, and then, yeah. So now you have these coefficients here and the coefficients there. And similar to what we did with the temperature, we can now consider, you know, correlation functions of these ALMEs and ALMBs. So, typically, or standardly, the original ALMs actually are ALMs for the temperature, are the temperature expansion coefficients. So if you talk about polarization, you actually add this T here, so that actually you know that this is the temperature expansion coefficient. Okay, so distinguish them from E and B. So sometimes people put this T, sometimes they don't. But yeah, it's the temperature expansion. And then, you know, can calculate correlation functions. So for example, you can consider ALM E and ALM, I don't know, B, okay? And this should be given by CL of E and B. So this will be, okay, so I'll have L prime, M prime, so delta L, L prime, delta M, M prime, and then CL, E and B. This is my two-point correlation function. You prepare the chair for me? Okay, I'll finish soon. okay, and similarly, you could define other correlation functions, right? So all you need to know is two-point correlation functions, but now you have lots of possibilities. You have EE and EB and EP and stuff like that, okay? But the truth is that, for example, if you consider the B modes, then there is some symmetry argument, the parity argument, that the only B mode, so B modes, you'll discuss them next time. So B modes, parity argument gives you that the only non-trivial is CLBB. Cl dB. So if you consider Cl TB or Cl EB, they'll actually have to be equal to zero by the parity argument. Anyway, so there's something to be said here about the BMOS, which I'll do next time. So let me stop here. Are there any questions to this? All right, see you tomorrow.